Well, I also would like to add to the chorus of thanks to Jen Vaughn and the network, the Feminist Economy Gift Network. I'm honored and really, really happy to be part of this historic conference. It feels as if something is coming together that I know so many of us have wanted for such a long time, some kind of integrated alignment with what we might have once called spiritual and feminist and political politics. I'm very thrilled to feel it in my gut coming together here and expressing itself in a powerful way. I guess I need to keep my finger on this button so I don't make them go backwards. Okay. The archetype of selfless or altruistic giving without attachment to outcome or any concept of reciprocity belongs originally and most fully to the goddess, the great mother of all things. The feminine force is active and life-producing, said Maria Gimbutas. Her body is parthenogenic, that is, creating life out of itself. Known scientifically as the Big Bang, her boundless creativity gave rise to the endless and diverse forms found in nature, whose beauty is impossible to replicate, and whose primary expression is unceasing, dynamic, cyclic growth, birth, death, and regeneration. This is First Woman. Her labia are swollen, the Aboriginal women say, because she's so sexually active. I see First Woman and the goddess as a great spider spinning the world from her center, reweaving the web of life again and again through eons and ages. This cyclic continuity should be enough to give us hope in our current situation, no matter how bad it gets. Since the first vulvas were inscribed on cave walls, and rock outcroppings tens of thousands of years ago, the female has been formally imaged as gift giver par excellence. The gift she gives of life and all that sustains it made a lasting impression on early humans coming to consciousness and beginning to express themselves through language and art. So-called Venus figures, that's not a very good slide, but you know the Venus figures, from the Eurasian Paleolithic period, with their huge breasts and buttocks emphasized over any distinguishing personal features, demonstrate the acknowledged gift-giving capacity of the being that would later be called the Great Mother, Mother Earth, Pachamama. The vulva, that sacred doorway, was the original glyph of a species becoming literate. It's a sign expressing gratitude, reverence, and awe towards the female body, with its marvelous ability to sustain and create life, and even in death to take it back as Mother Earth. Images of females dance among the pregnant animals which predominate in the caves and rock shelters used by humans in the ice ages. The female mysteries of periodicity and nature were at the center of whatever religious rites were practiced by early humans who upright walked out of Africa and journeyed east and west, eventually peopling vast continents. The first acts of human worship appear to have been in thanksgiving to the Mother of Life, inside of whose mystery we had awakened to ourselves. Clan structure developed around the mother of an extended household, who is still perceived in modern matriarchal societies such as the Mosso in China or the Meninkabau in Indonesia, as the central pillar of the home. At the end of the last ice age, the weather warmed over much of the planet, and our ancestors left their caves. This is the Mother Peace Empress card, some of you recognize. Many of them developed the ability to settle, grow food, and domesticate animals. Cultivation rather than being a revolution, as was once thought, apparently unfolded in a fairly natural way from the sophisticated gathering that had already gone on for millennia. The development of agriculture marks the beginning of the Neolithic around 10,000 years ago. One important center of agriculture, the Natufian, emerged in northern Africa, the Sinai Peninsula, and the Middle East, from which it was later carried to other places, including the female-centered early civilizations of Greece and Anatolia or ancient Turkey. Archaeologists, linguists, and biologists have tracked the spread of agriculture to the Caspian Sea and along the trade routes east that would much later be known as the Silk Road. The centers of agriculture also arose, maybe independently or through diffusion, they're debating this still, in China as well as the Americas. Women are universally credited with having invented agriculture, particularly the deliberate cultivation of plants and the various complex processes associated with it, like cooking, processing, food storage, extending to basketry, pottery, and other forms of vessels, as well as granaries allowing for a surplus of food for whole populations. The Dogon people of Mali equate the Sirius star system with their granary, seeing it as a reservoir and source of everything in the world. Egyptians called the same star Sothis, meaning to be pregnant, and represented it as the great goddess Isis. At Çatalhöyük, a 7th millennium town in ancient Turkey, I'm sure some of you have been there, an important female figure found in the granary is an enthroned woman sitting between two leopards. Ceramic vessels were crafted in the shape of the female body, emphasizing the biological functions of pregnancy and lactation, the female's concrete giving of the gift of life. Breasts on ceramic vessels used in ritual emphasize the female body, and by extension, the body of the divine female as a vessel of nourishment or renewal. The common equation of woman with hearth and home links to the evolutionary act of harnessing fire for cooking and warmth, as well as referring to the sacred nature of the hearth as altar, and the woman as shaman priestess. Portable offering tables or altars, this one from Crete, have been found in burials, female burials, since the beginning of civilization, indicating the ongoing function of the sacred woman. Among several tribes, this is a quote, traditions exist that the shaman's gift was first bestowed on women. In Mongolian myths, goddesses were shamans themselves, the daughter of the moon, and the bestowers of the shamanistic gift on mankind. Mankind. That's a quote. A Russian ethnographer from the early 20th century states that Neo-Siberians all have a common word for female shaman from the most ancient times, which has etymological links to the words bear, earth goddess, housewife, and wife. Among the Kamchadal in Kamchatka, there are no special shamans, she says, but every old woman and kokchuk, which she says probably means women in men's clothes, every old woman is a witch and explains dreams. They used no drum, but simply pronounced incantations and practiced divination. Birthing, ritual ceremonies, and the baking of bread happened more or less side by side in the early Neolithic temples of northern Greece. Ovens were created in the shape of a womb with an umbilicus, and pregnant female figurines were found nearby. Evidence of bread offerings are found in most sacred sites in Europe from as early as 12,000 BCE in the Ice Age caves of France through the Neolithic, thousands of years, and into the classical period when Dianic priestesses, witches, baked crescent-shaped cakes for the moon goddess. Today, it's the Catholic nuns who still bake the wafers for communion. And we still say she has a bun in the oven when we talk about a pregnant woman. Before, I wrote about this in Shakti Woman. Before this altruistic and communal nature of women was colonized and exploited, it functioned for the good of the whole, and society was able to sustain itself for several thousand years in peace. Even now, remnants of these ancient practices exist all over Europe, as I witnessed recently at Lipinski Vir in Serbia, where a village man brought this freshly baked loaf of bread to show the assembled group of scholars. The bread was decorated with old European symbols of goddess and formed in the shape of a mandala, not dissimilar from those used for meditation by contemporary Tibetan Buddhist practitioners. It's a fatal error to assume, as many people do these days, that the development of agriculture itself was the beginning of private property and domination. Ancient female-based agriculture was practiced in harmony with nature and presents us with an almost utopian model of sustainability and peace on earth compared with everything that has occurred since these civilizations were first disrupted during the fourth millennium BCE. At that time, with the introduction of male dominance, kingship, war, slavery, private property, the peaceful agricultural societies began to disappear, along with their languages, scripts, arts, and rituals. The incredibly beautiful artwork of a society like the one that predates Sumer, for example, which according to art historians has never again been equaled, was quickly replaced by mass production and the values of the bottom line, while images of women dancing and performing rituals diminish and were eventually replaced by men. Organic and biodynamic farmers today are instinctually groping their way back to what was once an intact system of complex and intelligent relatedness with all life. Our ancestors left us many images, artifacts, and physical signs of the successful continuity of culture, which they created and in which they successfully existed for several thousand years. Their central icon was the goddess, the mother of all things, whose centrality will have to be reestablished along with the women in leadership as her ministers. If progressives could begin to look at this legacy with open eyes, we could stop confusing the agribusiness of today with the agriculture of the past, of the ancient women. And instead, it's a really big confusion, isn't it? And instead, we could see matriarchal agriculture for the holistic model that it was and that it is for us still today. We would then be forced to stop claiming so ignorantly that there's always been war, there'll always be war, it's the human condition, which I hear a lot in progressive settings. Perhaps this realization would give us the impetus to refuse and reject the efforts of powerful corporations like Monsanto, currently involved in dangerously altering our food at the DNA level, as well as taking out patents, private ownership on life, like we've been talking about. I recently had the good fortune to visit Lipinski Vir, this place where the man brought the bread, the oldest Neolithic site in Europe. Situated on an inaccessible terrace overlooking the Iron Gates region of the Danube, separating Romania from Serbia, the site on the Serbian side and once facing a tumultuous whirlpool had to be moved when the river was dammed in recent years, dating from the mid-7th to the mid-6th millennia and composed of tombs and shrines in the shape of the female body. The site was not meant for habitation, but for rites of death and regeneration. The trapezoidal, can you see that at all? It's an old archaeological picture that was in the museum at the site, and all of the shrines at the site are these interesting trapezoidal triangles, which clearly represent vulvas, the sacred pubic triangle of the goddess, and were accompanied by enigmatic rock sculptures that archaeologists have always called fish goddesses, but which are also undeniably an expression of the much later Shilana gigs found all over the British Isles. These sculptures, many of which were covered in red ochre, show a wide-eyed, entranced woman figure with legs spread and hands pointing to or opening her triangular vulva. And just as in the earlier Paleolithic period, you know, 25,000 years ago, some of the rocks at Lipinski Vir had only a vulva incised, referring in the most abstract and refined way to the great goddess in her dual manifestation of life and death, death and rebirth. Because the human skeletons found at the site were mostly disarticulated and the skulls set aside for special care, often protected with a box of stones, it's likely that the people practiced secondary burial rites in which they, quote, laid out their dead in front of the shrines for excarnation. After the defleshing of the human bones by carrion birds, whose bones have also been found at the site, the remains were buried in the shrines. The earliest images of such sky burials are found in wall murals from Çatalhöyük, dated to the 7th millennium BCE. This is the place in central Turkey that so many of us have been interested in for such a long time. One painting shows two towers, this one, where one has the headless body placed there, and the other one, the head has been placed, with vultures approaching each. And notice one of the vultures has a double axe in her body, the earliest image of the double axe. A second painting shows vultures with human heads, human legs, and a headless corpse. Rites of excarnation or secondary burial were practiced all over old Europe and the Mediterranean region for many millennia, and in Central Asia as well. And remnants of this practice were carried on still in some places very recently. Gimbutas documented such practices in Italy, the Near East, Anatolia, Greece, and even as far north as the Orkney Islands, where skulls were routinely buried separately and skeletons disarticulated. The famous hypogeum that we saw Elizabeth's picture yesterday in Malta, for instance, contains the remains of 7,000 human skeletons that were deposited there over a period of 1,500 years. The site was simultaneously used as a gathering place for rituals, funerary rites, but also other communal rituals, a widespread custom of ancient pre-patriarchal people, life and death, all together. Frequently, these finds, skulls and disarticulated bones, some with cut marks, have led archaeologists to conclude that cannibalism and human sacrifice were practiced. Yet in Tibet, the ancient rite of sky burial is still practiced, where a corpse is taken to a specifically designated area outside of the town or village, often at the top of a mountain, and body breakers chop the body into pieces and feed it to vultures who are considered to be incarnate dakinis. Recent films about Tibet, for instance, 7 Years in Tibet or Kundun or Himalaya, you've seen some of those films? They show graphic representations of these funerary rites where pieces of flesh are laid out as a banquet and the giant screaming birds come to feast ravenously on the remains. We in the West tend to view such practices with alarm. This is the Mother Peace death card, of course. We view them often as primitive, barbaric, unnatural, or gruesome. Tibetans, on the other hand, view a 3-day-old corpse as lifeless and, quote, its purposes fulfilled. The manner of disposal is considered as a final act of generosity, enabling other animals to be nourished by one's remains. This is a sort of an extended version of what we were talking about yesterday in terms of the animals and the humans and our relationship as food. This seems to me to be a remnant of the ancient matriarchal understanding of our embeddedness in nature without such a dualistic phobia of death as we have cultivated in the West. A pre-Buddhist rock painting at an important site in Tibet, sacred to the goddess Tara, shows a bird-like female identified as a Kyung, sacred to Tibetans, and a precursor to contemporary sky women or dakinis. Dakinis are women who fly. This harks back to, just for you, I thought as Patricia read today, this harks back to megalithic sites all over Europe where excarnation was the main burial rite, skulls received special attention, and birds of prey were associated with the megaliths. These are pre-dynastic Egyptian. Bird goddesses and shamanistic sky-walking women are ubiquitous in the matriarchal strata in Europe and in Asia, Africa, and the Americas, suggesting a particular function of the female, widely celebrated, perhaps specializing in funerary rituals. Valkyries were corpse choosers who carried the souls of the dead off the battlefields, and Ovid described Scythian women as rubbing their bodies with flying ointments, just like the later European witches were purported to have done. Miranda Shaw reports on the siddhis, or the powers of the famous yoginis who, quote, could become invisible, had mastered the ritual gazes, and had the power of fleet-footedness, the ability to traverse vast distances in a matter of minutes. The lineage of Medea of Colchis, a shaman woman or sorceress known for her regenerative magic, may continue even today in a group of mostly women and girls living in the Caucasus who are called Mesuthele and described as sorceresses, according to a report by Janine Davis Kimball. They live among tribes considered to be descendants of Scythians and Sarmatians, and they fulfill a role very similar to that of Altaic shamans, like this one, falling into trances, escorting the dead to the underworld, or reincarnating them. Shamanism, once exclusively a women's province, is a sacrificial vocation in which the shaman uses her body as a vessel for powerful energies to flow through her in order to serve her community. In the most ancient times, women performed this function collectively in ecstatic rituals and communal ceremonies involving and on behalf of the whole community. Female Buddhas and high-ranking shaman priestesses are obvious from the artifacts and images from female-centered civilizations of old Europe. This one from Crete, for example, 6000 BC. Later, during the Bronze Age, as agricultural civilizations were disrupted and scattered by violence, a special amalgam, African, European, Asian, shaman priestesses emerged in the Mediterranean region. They were known as Maenads, with counterparts in the Indus Valley and also in northern Tibet, China's Tarim Basin. This one's still from Greece. Sorry, this is from Chios. And here, one of the first Europoid mummies found in the Tarim Basin from 2000 BC. And this one of the three witches of Subeshi, as they're known, from 6th century BC. Designated today as merely mediums, descendants of these special women are still able to make way for powerful healing energies to inhabit and work through their bodies. Female shamans are active in the contemporary societies of Japan and Korea, as well as in isolated regions of Russia and Mongolia. This image is, I'm back to the Greek islands. The ability to become empty is what I'd like to suggest is happening here, a state of samadhi. The ability to become empty is a formal goal of meditation practice, very highly regarded in Tibetan Buddhism and embodied by the Tibetan Dakini, or sky-going woman, whose selflessness is said to be, quote, compatible with activity in the world with or for the sake of others. This is like the Buddhist concept of the bodhisattva. You take a vow. One who incarnates for the well-being of others. In other words, one whose birth is a gift to sentient beings. The wisdom Dakini is described as being fully awakened and acts to awaken others. Oh, pretty hard to see. That's a Dakini, statue of a Dakini. The medicine Buddha has a female precursor in Tibet, a pre-Buddhist group of Tibetan female deities who often form sisterhoods, described as no longer popular and nearly extinct in the region. The Tibetan name, man, pertaining to both medicine and women, is defined as benefit or beneficence. It's also an honorific term for women in general. Scholar John Vincent Beleza says that women and the man share the same qualities, and man also came to mean medicine by virtue of its connection with the feminine qualities of nurturer and healer. The female manmo, which would be a demoness today, meaning benefactress, predates the later manpa, or male doctor. Beleza also states in general that although the appearance, theology, and culture of the great goddess could be altered, she was never eliminated. And although this mostly goes unrecognized, Dakinis are also believed to take human form as women. So any woman could potentially be acting as a Dakini at any time. As Simmer Brown puts in her new book, Dakini's Warm Breath, human women are the display that emptiness takes when it expresses itself in form. I call this the absent referent in Tibetan Buddhism. I'm working on a book to put the woman back into Tibetan Buddhism. She's referred to constantly. Today, Dakinis and Yoginis are treated mainly as abstract deities or yidams in the texts, interiorized into Indian and Tantric Tibetan Buddhist visualization practices. Nonetheless, their historical reality is strongly attested to. Beleza mentions Chinese references to Eastern and Western kingdoms of women, where women held dominant social and political roles in the autocracy and authority that was matrifocal. The area to the immediate west of Tibet was once known as Odiana, the land of the Dakinis. And Jujum Rinpoche, a high lama and head of the Nyingma lineage, is quoted as saying in the 20th century that the women of the region belong to an ancient race of Dakinis and still have the power over the arts of magic, gaze, transformation of objects by means of certain Gnostic spells, and some minor sorcery. In India, the so-called cult of the Yoginis, this is a Yogini temple from North India from the 8th century, embodied many of these same concepts. The Yoginis, known also as Matrikas, or circles of mothers, were famous for their eight cities, or supernatural powers. They represent an ancient lineage going back to the Indus Valley in Central Asia, continuing in some form to the present day in such self-proclaimed devis or shaman women as Amichi. Much of my research over the last decade has been to document the unbroken lineage of female shamanism across Afro-Eurasia, from ancient times to the present. The continuity of practices, rituals, and artifacts identifying the sacred women who have functioned as religious leaders in their communities all across the Silk Road for thousands of years was a main theme in my new book, The Double Goddess, Women Sharing Power. This is Greece, of course. In the book, I show direct links between Egypt, Africa, the Greek Maenads, Central Asian Amazons, Indo-Tibetan Dakinis and Yoginis, and European witches. All of them were known for their ability to fly through the air, heal the sick, resurrect the dead, brew sacred, intoxicating, fermented beverages like soma, and perform sexual and divination practices for which they have been misunderstood, maligned, peripheralized, and demonized in the modern world. A timely example of this negative bias is a Russian article describing a rich female burial recently excavated in the Crimea. That's like on the Black Sea, you know where that is. The Sarmatian woman who died in her mid-40s was buried with symbols of great wealth or rank, including her, quote, lavish dress, massive golden earrings decorated with garnets, golden necklace, and golden medals sewn to her dress. But it was the so-called occult inventory, 9 bronze rings, the same number of bells, and a whole array of different amulets and beads buried with her, that caused the archaeologist to jump to the incredible conclusion that she must have been a witch in the pejorative sense. Because, quote, all the relics date back to a much earlier period than the woman's corpse. He is quoted as saying, the witch must have dug out those accessories from ancient burials in order to intensify her magical practices. Isn't that amazing? Her magical powers. This is the kind of like, this is the unbiased scholarly research that comes out of the academy. In actual fact, heirloom artifacts are commonly found in important female burials from all over the ancient world and for a long period of time, especially during the Bronze and Iron Ages when they were on the run. They were trying to keep their thing going and they were migrating like crazy, and I wrote a lot about that in The Double Goddess. I think that's who the Amazons are. And these heirlooms were most likely passed down as cult items from one priestess in the lineage to the next. The shift from a gift economy to a commodity culture can be seen in the transition that occurred from matriarchal cultures to patriarchal ones everywhere, almost everywhere. Under patriarchy, shaman priestesses became witches, ogresses, demonesses, this is all in the literature, sacred harlots, temple prostitutes, and what was once freely given became a commodity controlled by male authorities in male-dominant social structures. Most recently, this shift occurred in India, where the Devadasis, the temple dancers, were still, until the 1950s, giving the gift of their bodies by dancing for the deity in the temples, cooking food in the temples to be shared communally with the worshippers in attendance, and performing the sacred sexual rites to benefit all beings. Because the British conceived of them as prostitutes, the Devadasis were outlawed and forced to stop practicing their ancient rites. This outlawing of the ancient female tradition of gift-giving coincides with the further colonization of women seen in the catastrophic rise of sex work and the female sexual slavery found around the world since then. Thank you.